right, everyone. Welcome to our second regular edition of Crypto Voices. My name is Matthew Majinskis, your host, joined along with my co-host, Fernando Ulrich. Fernando, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Matthew. And how are you?
Doing well. Been enjoying the crazy crypto markets over the past week. A lot of people are up in arms and tweeting tweet storms, hodling storms about all of it. Very exciting. But you got to look in the longer term, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, true. This is always my perspective, especially when we're speaking of an investment perspective. Whenever people ask me, okay, is this the moment to go into crypto, to go into Bitcoin? I say, well, it might be, but I always have in mind a 5 year or 10 years long-term perspective. So it doesn't matter if I'm buying at $2,700 or $2,200. So it doesn't matter.
Yep, totally agree. All right, so we got just a couple topics today. First thing I wanted to do was basically reiterate to the audience kind of what we're going to be talking about on this show, our thesis, our thoughts about cryptocurrency, about Bitcoin, about blockchain. And I kind of wanted to do that in the context of defining a couple terms. I remember when I was in university and I would hear like trying to figure out what I want to major in, what I was wanted to study. You know, I was definitely a numbers guy. I was definitely in sort of the business-oriented finance accounting subjects. But I kept hearing about economics, and some of my friends at other universities around the U.S., the subject economics, was sometimes in the business school, and it was actually sometimes in the liberal arts, the sort of maybe, you know, English, where the English department was. Yeah, it's very interesting to me. And I couldn't figure it out. You know, I mean, it's like finance, accounting, economics, they're all sort of similar similar topics, big picture, if you talk to anyone on the street today. But I couldn't honestly figure out the difference. You know, when I started to read more after the financial slide in 2008 and started to really figure out the principles of economics that I appreciated, I started to see that definitely economics was more of a science than the business topics of accounting and finance. You know, your day to day, you know, you're dealing with balance sheets, you're dealing with budgets, you're dealing with companies that are trying to, you know, make a profit, deliver value for their shareholders, all these things that companies do in the real world. But then I was always trying to figure out, okay, how does economics fit into this? Is it relevant or not? I didn't really enjoy my economics classes in university. But when I discovered the Austrian school, when I discovered, you know, Mises and Hayek and Rothbard and many others, a lot of things clicked for me. And I know that similar for you, similar for many people we know. But for me, it's interesting, and I think it's important that people have, basically you have a principle of where you're coming from when you think and you talk about economics. Because if you don't have a principle, then it really boils down to hubris and shouting matches. And you see that if you turn on any channel, certainly in the US, economists are there to advise the president. Economists are there to advise central bankers. Central bankers themselves are economists. And all these sorts of different shouting matches about what people think the economy should be or not. But it really comes down to principle. And for us, we've said it on the first show, but it is, for me at least, it's a principle of liberty, of freedom of choice, freedom to make your own decisions and to deal with the consequences, however they may come. For me, really, it's as simple as that. And, you know, there are some people that are interested to hear about that, some people that aren't. But you know, just to make it clear, I think that with economics, to really get to a nice endpoint in any discussion you're going to have with someone, you have to start with a principle. And for me, it's definitely about it's about freedom. It's about liberty. Those are the principles that click with me, and this is why we tend to draw towards the Austrian school, a more free market. You know, even maybe the Chicago school or some more free market oriented school, people have those sorts of principles. And if you don't, you're more drawn toward the Keynesian school, or you don't even know about it at all. You just follow whatever some blowhard says on TV telling you that, you know, we should increase spending here, we should decrease spending there, increase taxes there, decrease spending there. So for me, the most important thing is a principle. The second most important thing is to realize that there is no, this may change with blockchain, which is so exciting, but there just is no hard data in economics. It's a soft science. Basically, economics is very anecdotal. There's not a lot of hard data to back up what people are saying sometimes. And unless you have a solid principle to stand behind, I think it's just a lot of hubris. So I just wanted to get it out there at the beginning that these are sort of my views on economics. Of course, all of this will bleed into many of the topics that we'll talk about on this show. But what do you think about that?
If I had to choose where to assign central banking, I think I would put central banking on the art, liberal arts school, because economics, I totally agree, it is a science, but central banking, especially central banking that we have right now after the financial crisis, I mean, no way in hell this is science. I mean, this is witchery. So, but anyway.
But, yeah, no, it's good you brought up central banking. Keep going on that.
So I think it's much more liberal arts than science what central bankers are doing today. And even they themselves, they agree on this, and they actually acknowledge and confess that they are learning by doing, as Ben Bernanke famously said maybe 5 or 10 years ago. So they are learning by doing. But what is fascinating about Bitcoin and crypto and the economics or the science of economics is that with the current monetary theory, the prevailing monetary theory, and here I'm not talking just about Keynesians in Chicago or, you know, public choice, but even the Austrians themselves, even the Austrians have had a hard time explaining Bitcoin. For many Austrians to this day, they say, well, because there's no intrinsic value, or because it has no other use besides trying to be money, so it cannot exist. It's almost like this, that they're trying to explain or to unexplain Bitcoin. And the fact is, Bitcoin is here, it's alive, it's been functioning for over 8 years now. But many economists, they cannot conceive of Bitcoin. Last week, actually 2 weeks ago, I gave a talk at one of the best business schools here in Brazil. And I drew an audience of over 400 people, 400 students interested in hearing about Bitcoin. It was really fascinating, the enthusiasm. Yeah, it was really amazing. And one of the things that I said back then, actually I started my talk saying this, is that Bitcoin is not only the disruption of money, but it also means the disruption of economics. Because most of the economists, they cannot explain Bitcoin, they cannot understand, let alone explain Bitcoin. Because for them, the prevailing monetary theory, money comes from the state. Money's value arises from a decree, from a state decree from the sovereign. This is how monetary theory explains money today. So because of this, a private money cannot even emerge. And this is why Bitcoin is disrupting the economic science. The economists no longer have a choice of ignoring Bitcoin. Now it is here, they have to explain, they have to understand, but it's difficult with a theoretical background and the theoretical arsenal that they have. It's difficult for them to understand this and to explain and to see how this is going to unravel, because we've seen the adoption in Bitcoin is increasing, and I think it's going to keep increasing. But for them, it's always, they come down, it always boils down to the money or nothing fallacy. Well, if you see Bitcoin today, it's not really money, because it's not a universal medium of exchange. It is a store of value, though a volatile one, it is a store of value. But it's certainly not a unit of account. So Bitcoin is not money, and it has no use. Basically, this is how they sum up Bitcoin today.
Going further on that last point that you just mentioned, the store of value versus the unit of account. Does that have anything to do with what you said before about money cannot arise privately? Is it just two sides of the same coin, so to speak?
Kind of, yes. Because when we analyze how a money comes into being and how it becomes, how it evolves, how a medium of exchange, how a commodity, a good, evolves until the point
comes into existence.
Exactly. Until you can say, okay, now it is money. The more liquid a good is, a money is, the more it will be used as a unit of account. Or let's say being used as a unit of account is the mark of a very liquid money, or the most liquid money we have, the most liquid good, which is money. So because the fact that Bitcoin is currently is not a unit of account does not prevent that it might become a unit of account in the future. And this is what economists cannot conceive of.
No, I totally agree. And it's very interesting. I like the point basically that they explained it away or try to unexplain it. Because it's arrived privately. It hasn't arrived from the state. One more point on this. Do you have a theory on, or a position on money evolving, how money evolved, at like its most ancient times? You know, is it the regression theorem? Is that what you would say is sort of correct, which is basically that it in some way, shape or form, and correct me if I'm wrong, came from something durable, something tangible of value? Or could it be something like money evolved from barter? Or could it be something like money evolved from even from credit? Do you have any general opinion on that?
Yeah, I think Mises' regression theorem, I think it does explain Bitcoin. The thing is, many Austrian economists, they cling to the Mises' regression theorem as a justification, or perhaps as making the case, because the regression theorem cannot explain Bitcoin, thus Bitcoin cannot become money, it is a money, and so on. But I think that the theorem can indeed explain the emergence of Bitcoin. The thing is, mainly Austrian economists, when they talk about gold and the role that gold played as money, and because Mises uses primarily gold as its example, as its historical illustration of his theory. So the thing is, the regression theory uses gold as the example, but it is not by necessity that for a good to become money, it has to be a tangible good. Gold is just to illustrate the historical example for the theorem.
Yeah, that's actually where I wanted to get to, just to hit the bullseye. Was that explain Mises' regression theorem, if you could, in a sentence. Is it just it comes from something has to come? You know, we say Bitcoin has value today, and then okay, we saw that it had value yesterday. Okay, we saw that it had value the day before yesterday. But what is the regression theorem mean in a couple sentences?
Yeah, the regression theorem states that money's purchasing power comes from yesterday's money's purchasing power, and so on until you reach a point, so to avoid a circular reasoning, until you reach a point where this good being money was valued entirely by its other uses, by non-monetary uses. So for a good to become money, it must have a prior monetary use, non-monetary use. So this is what the regression theorem
states. So in the case of Bitcoin, is it generally accepted? We would say its value comes from the electricity that's used to produce it?
Well, that's we can have a huge debate on this. And this is where the Austrian economists, where they don't agree with Bitcoin, because they say, yes, Bitcoin didn't have any prior use before becoming money, or before being used as a medium of exchange. And the fact of the matter is, what the theorem doesn't say is that it doesn't matter how deeply this non-monetary use was, or how extensively it was used as another for any other purpose. It just states that a commodity must have been demanded by another use other than monetary, other than for being used as a medium of exchange. That's all. So in this regard, if we say that the enthusiasts and the programmers, the coders, when they started playing with Bitcoin, they were just demanding Bitcoin because they wanted to test the system, this new and nascent technology. And this
and
was
the cool
demand.
Factor.
And that, the cool factor,
the cool factor,
yeah,
as well. They were, the geek factor.
They were actually consuming Bitcoin, let's say. They were demanding to consume it, not to use it in exchange. That could happen in the future, but back then, in 2009, they had absolutely no idea if that would be the case in the future.
Yep, got it. This is a fascinating topic, one that I think we do need to explore further in the future, but we'll leave that there for today. One more question though regarding that. Do you consider yourself an economist, Fernando?
Wow, that's a philosophical question, introspective question. I think I do. Although my major is in business administration, I just had a master's degree in economics. I think I do. I always try to approach things from an economic perspective. So try to understand and explain and not try to input your personal bias or your personal taste or preference.
Great. All right. You are going to be the professor of our show then. So you are you are going to be the authority that
all right.
I and our guests are going to appeal to. No, I think it's very interesting. It's a very interesting point. You know, I mean, as I was saying, economists, depends on the definition. What's your pedigree? Do you have a master's? Do you have a doctorate? Or do you work at the Fed? Do you work at a university? It's very interesting. I mean, I would consider back to what I was saying before about the beginning about economics. I definitely have a more of a business, financial, analytical background, and I have practiced that in my career. So I've always sort of, I call myself an analyst professionally. You know, I know you're not even in, I know you give lectures and stuff, but you wouldn't introduce yourself as an economist, obviously, but
no,
I would probably say, you know, I'm an economic observer. I enjoy reading, you know, not the most scholarly detailed papers, but a lot of blogs and things from people of interest. It's fallen off a little bit as of late when I've been trying to consume so much just pure crypto info, but that's an interesting another topic as well, I think, when we talk about crypto economics and free market economics. Is it's interesting to try to define those things. Okay, I think that's good. Let's move on to our second and sort of main topic of the show. Our first economic topic regarding Bitcoin. We're going to talk about the supply. I think that the supply, if you know nothing else about Bitcoin, nothing else about crypto economics or cryptocurrency or blockchain, I think the most important thing that you need to understand with Bitcoin and any cryptocurrency is its supply, its rate of inflation, and its projected future max cap or max supply, and the schedule that will occur at. I think that is such a, you know, you touched on a little bit last week, but it's such a basic, important part of cryptocurrency that really everyone should understand it. And it's very interesting, the implications. So what do you have to say about the supply of Bitcoin and why is it so important?
This is actually another issue the economists in general have with Bitcoin, because since Bitcoin's money supply is a, let's say, asymptotic money supply targeting, because it has a decreasing money supply growth rate. So it started out with 50 Bitcoins per on a 10 minutes on average, every 10 minutes, and it decreases by half every 4 years. So until the year 2140, more or less, we will reach the 21 million cap of Bitcoin's total Bitcoins in circulation that can never yep. exist.
We say disinflationary in our lexicon, not deflationary, which would be a decrease, but a decrease in the rate of inflation, disinflationary rate.
That's a very important distinction, because mainstream economics, when they look at Bitcoin, they say Bitcoin is a deflationary currency, because what they mean is the purchasing power of Bitcoin is going to increase over the years. Yeah. So this is what they say, it's a deflationary currency. So this is the first criticism by economists, because they say Bitcoin as a currency, okay, it's cool, we can gain more mainstream adoption or gain more in adoption, but it can never, an economy can never work with a deflationary currency. This is their argument. And I concede that this is still up for debate, if an economy can work with a money that by definition will gain purchasing power over the years. We had gold in the past, and it was in many instances, it had a deflationary moment or years. But we can still debate this. But the thing is, for the rationale behind this asymptotic money supply targeting was to mimic a scarce commodity as gold. So gold is perhaps the example per excellence that we have as a money, a commodity that functioned as money for thousands of years. So it was easy to decide upon this. So to mimic gold's supply over the years, gold's supply, reserve supplies in the world. And this is what Bitcoin is trying to do. And this is actually crucial for the adoption of Bitcoin and for people to actually demand and be willing to hold Bitcoins. Because this is one of the things we must be clear. Since Bitcoin has no state backing, meaning there's no decree or legal tender laws demanding people or obliging people to use Bitcoin in whatever instance, there must be an economic incentive for people to be willing to hold Bitcoin. And this is where the money supply schedule falls into place. It is perhaps one of the best mechanisms to incentivize people to hold, to demand and to hold Bitcoin. And one of the ways to explain Bitcoin's value as a currency, as an asset.
Absolutely. Anecdotally, I can say in the last week, even with this all-time high hitting, you know, over $2,700 per BTC, you know, the altcoin market exploding, etc., I personally have received more personal requests for more information about it, how to get involved, how to buy some, what wallet to use, more than I've ever received. And I think it's exactly illustrating your point. Of course, it's just a little anecdotal evidence. Again, we don't have, hard data on the exchanges, and the demand is at all-time highs there as well. I mean, billions of dollars. I mean, you know, before this year, $1 billion traded in 24 hours was absolutely massive for Bitcoin. True. And again, like we said, during the QE days of the Fed or the ECB today, $1 billion could be done in a couple hours of printing.
So just it's hitting all a relative. Keyboard stroke.
Yeah, it's all relative and very, very interesting. That was the next thing I wanted to bring up, though, and ask you is, what is your opinion then on the... So I think you very eloquently and elegantly gave some information on why this disinflationary or asymptotic supply curve of Bitcoin is important. What do you think then about the supply of money from national fiat governments around the world and how they manage their supply?
That's interesting. We had a free market example of a digital, a cryptocurrency, which tried to introduce a money supply schedule mimicking what we have in our fiat money system. It was called Frycoin. So Frycoin was kind of a Keynes currency. So they had an inflationary rate, and of course it couldn't go on much further, because people, instead of having an incentive to hold, they had an incentive to spend. This was the other way around. So this was a perfect illustration of the theory. So when you don't have a state backing the currency, you need to have another incentive to make people be willing to hold the currency. So when we compare Bitcoin's money supply with what we have today in the fiat system, be it the dollar, the euro, the real in Brazil, it's what we today have is what's called a inflation targeting mechanism. So all most of the central banks in the world, they target a given rate of inflation measured by the index they choose. So this is how it's done. And the way the toolbox they use to reach to this target is by manipulating interest rates. So they don't actually target a given supply of money. They used to do this back in after the Bretton Woods collapse, so in the 70s and a little bit in the 80s. They did target money supply. But this is also one of the problems we have in our current system, because what central banks can actually influence directly is bank reserves and paper currency, so currency in circulation. But beyond that, and this would be the monetary base, but beyond that, M1, M2, which includes sight deposits, or demand liabilities by bank, or time deposits, savings deposits, these are all money created by banks, or liabilities created by banks, which function as money. They are used as money and used in exchanges. So, and central banks cannot really control this money supply, just the monetary base. So they had to abandon this, and then they moved to inflation targeting, to manipulating interest rates. And this is where we are right now. They're trying to influence the level of inflation, the rate of inflation, by manipulating interest rates. And then the money supply is just a consequence of this manipulation.
Yeah, I've heard Selgin, George Selgin, who I enjoy reading a lot of, Free Banker, Misesian as well, he would call himself. He says, you know, the central bankers today, they don't want to talk about the stock of money anymore for exactly, I think, the reasons that you described. They don't want to talk about how much money they are adding or decreasing to the money supply. The traditional, you know, the Adam Smith or classical economic definition of inflation, the actual stock, the balance sheet of money, they don't want to talk about anymore. They want to talk about flows, they want to talk about interest rates, and they want to talk about prices. And that's, you know, you can use that definition, price inflation, price deflation, but that's not the classical traditional definition when you would talk about money in an economy. And why do you think, I mean, I know you sort of mentioned, but why do you think that they got away from it? Why are they so interested in focusing on interest rates and on prices, price inflation today?
Well, one of the reasons is because they failed miserably, because they tried to control the money supply, they tried to control prices, to influence and to maintain a price stability by influencing the money supply. And they failed miserably. They couldn't do this. So they had a terrible track record of having stable prices by controlling the money supply. So they moved on to this inflation targeting, which is the rationale we have today. But again, as Ben Bernanke said, the central bankers, it's not a science. I mean, it's an impossible job. To know the exact supply of money is something, as any other good in the market, is something that can only be decided by the free decisions, by the free choices of individuals, this supplying money and demanding money. Central banks cannot decide this, or a bureau, a politburo, a committee, they cannot decide this from above. So they have an impossible job.
It's what Hayek wrote about in Road to Serfdom, which was at the time one of the most, you know, forward-thinking or radical views for an economist to make.
It was.
You know, a planning board, a board of individuals, you know, just realize at face facts that you cannot know the exact amount of money that should be in circulation, and that definitely is very radical. So how do you think we're going to square that with cryptocurrency? Obviously, let's stick with Bitcoin here. Obviously, the price is rising. It generally tends to rise. You know, it could fall for a couple months if it got overheated, but it generally, if you look at a chart back to 2009, even with the blip, the big bubble in 2013, it's generally tended to rise. So what do you think is going on there? What is Bitcoin telling us?
Well, I think it's going to grow into the best thermometer of central banking failures, or the inflation, the printing of money and financial crisis, political crisis, Bitcoin will be the best thermometer for this kind of stuff. And my belief is that it will keep decreasing. It will keep gaining adoption. I suspect the price will still be volatile for a couple of years, or maybe even more than that, 5 or 10 years. But yeah, volatility will also decrease, as it has decreased over the 5-6 years.
Good. I think that's a very good summary. I want to close here by having a little fun at the numbers, looking at the numbers. I love doing this. It's a great exercise. And of course we could apply this to any market that has potential to disrupt or to impact or to penetrate the incumbents. But I really enjoy looking at sort of the current global stock and comparing the value of Bitcoin and other cryptocurrency. I've looked online. The best sort of, I know that you look at a lot of central bank data and look at the balance sheet, the monetary base. That's the base rate, M0 supply of money in various countries. I've looked at a couple different publications. One I really like was from McKinsey. They were doing this every few years, and they would go back many years in their history. They just sort of compiled a global balance sheet, a global stock of debt and equity. I can put a link in the show notes. The last one I found was from 2012. So that was even before some of the major quantitative easing of the Fed, ECB, obviously, Bank of Japan and others. But the I just want to run just a couple numbers by you and hear your thoughts. So they have the global balance sheet, let's say the global stock of debt and equity. So, and for those now back to the business side, you know, assets always equal debt plus equity. That's just the accounting equation. It always holds. So assets equal debt plus equity. Back in 1990, they said it was $56 trillion. Just straight up, we're not adjusting. I mean, it's just the stock of money. In 2012, the stock market capitalization alone, that's all stock markets in the world, were $50 trillion. Public debt securities outstanding, which I take to mean pretty much the monetary base, was $47 trillion. And then there's a couple other ones, securitized loans, non-securitized loans. I'll just lump them all together and call them debt, corporate debt, private debt. That was $128 trillion. So that's a grand total. You have, so again, your equity is stock markets, $50 trillion. Public debt securities, government debt, $47 trillion. And then all other loans in the world, $128 trillion. This is as of 2012, that's $225 trillion. Now, this is not counting, obviously, by my understanding, things such as rehypothecation, which the IMF and what's the World Bank, they have estimated, I think it could be 3 or 4 times the global stock of debt. So maybe we don't apply it to the 225 trillion, but you can, if you count rehypothecation, which is basically two banks making the same claim on one asset, that number could be much, much higher. It could be close to $250 billion. We just don't know. Blockchains will help us with that. But the latest number I could find, 225 trillion global balance sheet, 2012. It's probably much higher right now. And then, obviously, as I said, we could apply this to many markets that we think have massive growth potential. But at BTC's current price, its current coin circulation, about 16.3 million, what percentage do you think that represents of the global balance sheet, the global stock of debt and equity in the world?
0.00005%.
It's actually higher than that. It's higher than that. It just, when it crossed, when it was around $1,000, it was 0.01%. So 0.01%. Now, when it was about 2,700, it was 0.02%. So 0.01% of the global stock of debt and equity. That's the global supply of money, all circulating in the world, or at least people that think they have a claim on that money. And obviously massively, massively small. You can do your own calculations from there, take it to a percent where you think the price could go. it's a fun number to look at. I love just looking at that over time. And I would love to get some new figures as well.
It's really unbelievable. It's really unbelievable. And all this debt creation, it all leads back to base money creation. So paper currency, which is debt by the state, a Federal Reserve note, it is a state debt, it is a public debt. And it all leads back to base money creation, which all central banks today around the world, they can inflate the currency as much as they're willing to, or as much as their monetary and economic theory can justify. And fortunately, today we do have at least one asset, a new digital asset, which no one can inflate, and this is called Bitcoin.
Well said, my friend. I love it. And we'll go back to those numbers frequently. There's many others that are interesting to compare. Even, you know, the total gold markets, total Forex markets, many other markets we can look at, remittances, where we can sort of compare Bitcoin to those markets and see how big it is and how it's going to grow. You know, obviously, that's a general statement. We're not speaking with huge trends or when we think that could happen, but it's a very, very fascinating thing, I think, to look at the global market capitalization of Bitcoin, compare that to the global stock of all the money that they've printed in the world. And this is why having a fixed or a limited or restrained supply on money is so important. Anything else you want to add to that?
No, I think this is it's been great talking to you. I think we raised many interesting points. And again, I'm looking forward to the next show.
All right, Fernando, thanks a lot. And we'll talk to you next week.
Take care, Matthew.
All right, bye-bye.